Have you ever wondered how Charlotte's crown logo came to be or how the Queen City became a banking city? Vote for one of those questions and WFAE will answer it in an upcoming episode of the FAQ City Podcast. Find the podcast and cast your vote now by going to WFAE.org/FAQ City. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The atrium at Atrium Health must be filling up with lawyers. This week, they're being sued by 100 doctors wishing to be released from their employment agreements and free of their non-compete clauses. At the same time, Atrium has filed a countersuit in their disagreement with an anesthesiology group. City Council spent time this week reconsidering red light cameras. Members appear skeptical, but the discussion isn't over. 12th District Congressional Democrat Alma Adams faces some challengers in the primary who are using their age as a weapon in what is being billed as a battle of the generations. And more billionaires come to get the lay of Panther land, even as the Charlotte Chamber president urges a mindset of being prepared to ante up for the new owner. Our roundtable of reporters has details on those and other stories this hour on our local news roundup. Nick Oxner, a reporter for WBTV.
Hello.
Welcome back. It's very strange, man. Don't get too close. Glenn Perkins joins us. He's editor and publisher at QCityMetro.com. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Ann Doss Helms is here, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Good morning.
We're all on the radio, but if that isn't enough for you, you can watch us on Facebook Live this morning. Atrium, with their planned merger, their called-off merger, an actual merger, the name change from Carolina's healthcare system, their public battle with anesthesiologists. They have become, I hesitate to say this, quarter in the jar, they have become the new HB2 of this program. They just can't stay out of the news. This week, over 90 doctors sued Atrium Health to be released from their employment and non-compete agreements, and very quickly, the hospital relented, announcing that they will allow the doctors to operate independently. So what's behind this? Here's Dr. Dale Owen.
The amount of time designated to actually be able to see the patient is significantly inhibited, and that doesn't allow us to take care of their complex medical problems in that period of time.
So this comes from doctors with Mecklenburg Medical Group, which includes internists, gastroenterologists, endocrinologists, dermatologists, hepatologists, pulmonologists, are there any other, sleep medicine doctors, and cardiologists. They want more time with patients. They sued for freedom. What does this tell us?
Well, I think the backdrop to all this that we need to remember is back in February, Dion Roberts got memos about the Destination 2020 four-year strategic plan that CEO Gene Woods was rolling out, and the focus was to cut labor costs as a percentage of revenue. So we're not used to thinking of doctors as labor, but this is basically a lot of this legal mess that we're seeing play out in very disturbing for the patient ways is a labor dispute, and the doctors... I take everything with a little bit of a grain of salt because everybody here is an interested party and everybody is saying we're about protecting the patients. Those other bad guys are about squeezing out money and harming patient care. So,
how do you ferret out the truth of all this?
Well, one thing I would say is that this says as much about the medical industry probably as it does about Carolina's or Atrium. This isn't just an Atrium thing. Doctors across the health spectrum talk and complain about not being able to spend as much time with their patients as they would like to. In my own doctor visits, I felt it. It's very unusual now to have a doctor actually see you for very long because there are just so many people there.
Well, this is reminiscent. This part of the conversation is reminiscent of the conversation that we had during the healthcare debate when President Obama was trying to get healthcare passed, and people who are opposed to his health government involvement in healthcare said, we don't want bureaucrats or insurance companies telling doctors how long they can spend with patients. That's one of the points of conversation. No one's talking about this here except the doctors involved. The public's not involved. Politicians haven't chimed in about this. People haven't said, I want my doctor to spend more time with me. What's up with that? Why is it not important now?
Well, do people even know? Do they remember anymore? If you think about it, for the last 10 or 15 years, we've we've grown accustomed to seeing a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant instead of an actual medical doctor or a DO. And I think that's what we've become accustomed to. But I think the fact of the matter is that is all necessary because – and this isn't necessarily a bad thing, but when you expand healthcare, access to healthcare to more people, that means you have more humans going to receive health services. And we didn't expand the number of providers overnight.
That was another object of the conversation when we were talking about healthcare, that this would provide more access and there aren't enough doctors. But if you're talking – if you take Atrium's side of this where they're saying that they want to reduce labor costs, what did you say? The labor cost as a percentage
of revenue.
Of revenue. Does that necessarily also lower costs to patients and insurance companies, or is it just more profit for a nonprofit?
Right. They say it does, but again, this is a very complicated financial picture. And like I say, there's that little asterisk for me every time somebody who's an interested party is saying it will do all these good things and none of the bad things. I say prove it.
I think here's what we have to remember is that Atrium, at the end of the day, is actually a county-run hospital, although it doesn't like to remember that and doesn't like to act like it. And at some point, I think it's fair to ask the question, when you're talking about maximizing your profits by reducing labor costs, are you really there to serve the public good or are you there to make a lot of money?
And that money goes to what? Aside from executive salaries, what does it go? If you have a lot of money coming into a nonprofit, mm-hmm. where does it go? Do they put it back into the equipment? Do they improve the facility? What do they do with it?
That's what they would probably tell you.
I think all of that's probably true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Why did they relent so quickly? They're still fighting in the newspaper and on radio with Southeast Anesthesiology, but they backed down from this non-compete clause.
They could fight in some TV ads. That'd be great too.
It's not clear to me. They are saying that the doctors can leave, and I don't think that's necessarily the focus of the dispute. The question is under what terms the doctors can leave. So I think that there is some progress on that. I don't think that's completely in the column of resolved over everybody's feeling good. I think they are still wrangling over what sort of non-compete terms those Mecklenburg Medical doctors might have to face, because if they have to give up the opportunity to practice in this area, then being able to leave is kind of a hollow victory.
Yeah, well, the hospital relented on that pretty quickly. Why? Aside from not wanting to spend a lot of time on this and the other very public disagreement with the other medical group, why did they relent?
Well, I think we know that there's a wave building in this country, as someone who's bound by one, against non-compete clauses, and it's not a good look for you. I think maybe they probably figured out smartly that it is not a good look to try to just stop people from competing against them, especially when you're talking about doctors who, you know, you see already the one pretty sustained and protracted ad campaign against them from a different group of doctors. It's just not a good look to try to keep them from being out there practicing medicine.
So if I could recall correctly, the other group he's talking about, the Southeast Anesthesiology Consultants, they're going to be replaced by Scope Anesthesiologist
right.
Group or something like that on July 1st. And they've been fighting this out very publicly in full-page ads in the newspaper, also radio ads on some radio stations.
For those of us under 60, on Twitter as well.
Twitter, Facebook, they have a website.
Okay.
I mean, they are really – this is a big PR campaign.
And it is, and it's very unusual. We should talk about that. Mm-hmm. But they also, I believe, have a non-compete, don't they? Yeah, Southeast Anesthesiology. Are they – because they waived it for Mecklenburg Medical, will they now have to waive it for Southeast
Anesthesia? Again, I'm not sure. Are we sure they have waived it for Mecklenburg Medical, or are they just
– That is the impression I got from the reporting that I read, is that they relented and said, we will release you from your non-compete.
Okay. So, and the hospital's confirmed that?
No, that's just
– That's what we were understanding.
That's my impression.
Yeah, I think – and you guys have, I think, a panel coming up on this where you'll have a couple of reporters who are specializing in reporting this, right, next week. So they may be able to really – and things develop – by the hour, you know, so there may be new insights on that.
Yeah, that's, I think, the fact that we don't know is also interesting, isn't it? Especially in what we really don't know either is the impact this is going to have on people's health care in this town, which is what it boils down to.
Well, and the Southeast Anesthesiology thing is a really complicated scenario in that you have not only Atrium, which is saying, you know, the doctors are saying Atrium has done these horrible things, they're sacrificing patient care. But Southeast is owned by its own medical care group, Mednax. And so now this countersuit, you basically have the anesthesiologist suing Atrium saying, you brought in this consultant, Dr. Wary, and we gave him all this information and we talked about ways to streamline costs, and then all of a sudden, he's not just the consultant, he's the competition, and he is now the head of the group that has gotten the contract.
And that's why they're suing.
That's why they're suing.
But what is the countersuit?
Atrium
is
now
a countersuit by Atrium.
Two big points of it. One is that they are defaming them with this ad campaign, which is very menacing and is saying some pretty direct things about,
Atrium, punches being held.
Yeah, you have these full-page photos of a close-up of a hand holding a scalpel, and who will they cut next? I mean, that's getting very direct. So part of it is a defamation suit, but part of it
is that today's paper?
That's actually yesterday's. Today's is a new one.
The ad in today's paper actually mentions all the other the other medical group and all the doctors that are involved, the internist, the gastroenterologist, the endocrinologist, the dermatologist, the hepatologist. They list them all in that ad, which if you're a casual observer of this, that might be alarming to you.
Yeah, this is definitely not a great PR situation for Atrium. But Atrium is now saying that it's actually Mednax that took this consultant's report, which was supposed to be confidential, and selected sort of the most extreme parts of it and gave it to the doctors and essentially manipulated the doctors against Atrium. So this whole deal with the consultant slash competitor has turned out to be kind of a big stink pot with both sides. And again, Atrium is saying that the bad guys here is not Atrium, it's Mednax, that they're the ones that actually are squeezing their own doctors.
And yes, and Atrium points out, I believe, that there have been doctors within that group who have taken issue and even sued Mednax.
Right.
But yesterday, Dr. Russell Sauder, who is corporate medical director of Southeast Anesthesiology, wrote an opinion piece in The Observer. Is The Observer, by the way, going to do the are they going to let Gene Woods have an opinion piece?
I would assume so if he submits one.
Okay, so they let this guy have an opinion piece in The Observer, and he said the public spat, these are his words, public spat with Atrium Health is not about a contract. The outcome, he says, will impact every individual in our community and arguably the country. And he reiterated, in their opinion, this disagreement has always been about patient safety and who gets to decide what that means, physicians or administrators.
I think that kind of goes back to what Ann said. I think you have to take that with a grain of salt. There's probably some truth there, but it is about a contract. At this point, they're being shut out by this new consultant who suddenly emerged as the competition. Mm-hmm. With so many bad things being said, you have to wonder. When this is just going to become so muddy that neither side can step back, even if they can work out an agreement, because this has gotten really nasty.
And Mecklenburg Medical, in their suit against Atrium, claimed that Atrium had enacted changes that are harmful to patients under what the hospital calls care redesign, cutting the number of assisted registered nurses and having a staff member available to answer patient calls. They were going away. Historically, many lay people have regarded doctors as God. So how is this going to go over with the public, particularly those who are of the age where they might have to visit the hospital a lot? When they see the doctor as God and the hospital is trying to cut out the doctor, will they trust the hospital? Has this led to any negative outcomes? Have people decided not to go there and go to Novant instead?
I think you may have answered that question you asked earlier about why they relented so quickly. Patients have relationships with the doctor. We don't have relationships with the hospital as such. We know our doctors. So, I think that point's very valid.
Or with anesthesiologists. I mean, they literally hold your life in their hands if they are doing surgery. But this Mecklenburg Medical Group, these are doctors that you're seeing face to face. You're not picturing a corporate entity. You're picturing the doctor that you go see.
How much of this is just the fact that Gene Woods is new as the CEO and he's making changes? And when any new guy comes in, they make changes and people don't like change. How much of it is that? And we had 15 seconds.
I think it's the changes he's making more than the fact that it is change per se.
Okay. We're going to do a program, as you alluded to, Ann, on this on Tuesday with Alex Olgan, our healthcare reporter, and Dion Roberts. We're coming right back on Charlotte Talks.
Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. Do you have 5 minutes to spare? If you do, then we'd love for you to take our Charlotte Talks listener survey. Super quick, super important for us. And you can find it right now on WFAE.org. We appreciate the feedback. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins is here from QCityMetro.com and Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Let's shift our attention, shall we, to red light cameras. Mayor Vi Lyles likes them. She likes red light cameras. These are the things that take your license plate picture if you run a red light. We've had them before, but they've been gone for 12 years, and she would like to see them make a return. Why did they leave in the first place? Remind us.
The city wasn't getting as much revenue from them as it had hoped. I think a judge ruled that the bulk of the money, 90% of the money had to go to the school districts. And they were basically costing the city money.
Because all these companies are in Florida. What's up with that? There was a company in Florida who, I guess, owned the cameras, put them up, paid to maintain them, and then they sent you the citation from Florida if you got a citation for running the red light.
I did.
Do you want them to come back?
I did not run the red light. I want to be clear on that.
So, but they would send you the citation. They administered the program. But then the state or some judge said that, as Glenn just said, 90% of the revenue had to go to schools. So we couldn't afford to pay the company their fee to administer the program. So they had to go. Has any of that changed if people want to bring them back?
No, it's still going to be a cost to the city, and that's what makes it part of what makes it so controversial. I think if it were clearly an overwhelming safety benefit, then there would be people saying, I think it's somewhere between $750,000 to close to $1 million a year that it would cost the city. If you were sure you were getting big safety benefits, there would be a pretty strong case for spending that.
Right.
There's some back and forth about which type of accidents it prevents. If it does deter people from running red lights, those are some pretty serious collisions. Sometimes there are more, the person stops abruptly and somebody rear-ends that person. There are conflicting data points about that. So it is unclear how much benefit they would get for their spending.
In fact, when I was working in Norfolk, Virginia, where Marcus Jones came from, and I covered him as city manager when he was in Norfolk, and red light cameras in Norfolk were under scrutiny and in that region, and a study came out that found an increase in rear-end accidents at red light cameras. So, yeah, to Ann's point, I'm not sure
I'm sorry.
No, I'm not sure that it actually reduces the number of collisions.
I'm assuming that this was on the agenda for city council because the mayor would really like to explore the opportunity to bring these cameras back. But as you mentioned, city manager Marcus Jones, who used to be in Norfolk and he has experience with these cameras, he doesn't like the idea, and he offered council a word of caution.
There are so many other things that are also happening now that you may want to invest more in the future.
Did he have any specifics about that?
If he did, I haven't read them.
No, and I think he was trying to make the point, if you want this purely for safety, well, we can find some other safety things. And then, I think Councilman Braxton Winston said, why don't we hang up crumpled metal pieces of car at intersections? I think Tariq Bakari said, let's explore some other options as well. But no one has any other definite things. But I think it's fascinating to watch Marcus Jones be, by his standards, relatively vocal about this issue on not wanting red light cameras. And the council still saying, or at least a faction of the council saying, we really think we want red light cameras. It is fascinating.
Well, Mayor Pro Tem Julie Eisel, I don't think she can be described as exactly gung-ho on the idea, but she does want to leave the door open.
If we prevent a couple of people from being killed, a couple of students on their way to school, then I don't know. It might be worth it.
As you mentioned, Braxton Winston is not terribly in favor of him. He thinks we should think about ways that we can impact behavior outside of criminalizing. Is this criminalizing behavior by having a red light camera that cites you? Is that criminalization?
It's certainly penalizing.
And his suggestion about putting the wreckage out there, I immediately thought, look at the way people rubberneck. How many more accidents would there be because I'm pulling up to that light and all of a sudden I'm gawking at the wreckage instead of paying attention to the light or the car in
front of me? Is that a fender on the light pole?
And to expand on Tariq Bakari, another newcomer to council, he said, this is something that has a material percentage impact on what is a very small percentage of our broader challenge and problem. Tariq is very smart, but I have no idea what that means.
You got me.
I think he was saying it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, thank you. Well put.
And Councilwoman Luana Mayfield also expressed reservations. If they voted right now, which way would the vote go, do you think? Would they say up or down?
Sounds like
yes or no.
Well, what they did say was, let's keep talking about it. Yeah. The all-purpose fallback position.
Which is fascinating to me. No one seems to be really gung-ho, and yet everyone seems to waste time talking about a thing no one's excited about.
Is that because we have a new mayor, and she's really changing the style in which a mayor operates in the city, and they want to help her out, they want to help her achieve her style?
Well, that could be. And if this was her idea, I think you could say that there's far more support for the mayor on this council than there was on the last council. And maybe they don't want to bash her, you know, too quickly. But I don't see this happening. Maybe.
All right. Well, when will they make a decision? Do we have any ideas on the calendar for a vote date?
When they're done talking about it.
Okay.
It is up next month, I believe.
Yeah. But, you know, that could always change.
All right. North Carolina primary elections are just around the corner. And in the 12th congressional district, Democrat Alma Adams, the incumbent, is facing some challenges. Among them, 36-year-old Gabriel Ortiz and 37-year-old Patrick Register. Adams is 71. So this has become known as the Battle of the Generations. Is that because younger people have made her age or their age an issue?
Yes, those two explicitly have cited her age and their youth, and they are saying they want to ride that wave. You just quoted several under 40 council members who were elected in this past election. They see that as potentially a trend that could benefit them in their quest to defeat an incumbent, which is, by the way, a very challenging thing to do. I think this is still a long shot. There are actually three challengers. Two of them have cited the age issue.
I mean, the Democratic Party nationally is very hopeful about taking back the House of Representatives in this midterm election. Is it wise for Democrats at any level, at any state, to be running against Democratic incumbents in the primary? Do you really want an unknown entity running against the Republican in the fall if you want to take back the House?
I guess only if that incumbent is hugely unpopular, which I don't think Alma Adams is. Age notwithstanding, she spends a lot of time in her district. She's here quite a bit. I probably see her out as much as, if not more, than I see any elected official from Congress. So I think they're going to have a hard time making that stick. One of them said she doesn't care about the district. You know, people say a lot of things during campaigns, but
why would she not care about the allegation carry water?
Well, you would have to ask him that question.
This isn't the first time that issue has come up, and I think it's interesting and maybe a cause to your point for being in the district a lot. I agree, she's here all the time. But if you call, Alma Adams was first elected in the old 12th district, which snaked along I-85 from Charlotte to Greensboro. She's from Greensboro, and she did most of her public service representing people in Greensboro and Guilford County until they redrew the district, and she moved to Charlotte. And there was questions about whether or not she actually moved. We investigated that. And that was an issue in her last Democratic primary 2 years ago. That being said, I think since then, she has been here an awful lot to tell people, hey, look, I'm here. But I still think it lingers as a question and as a fair opening, you know, if I'm trying to find a wedge issue to challenge her on, to say, well, she's still from
Greensboro. And she won that primary against some very strong challengers who are quite well-known in Charlotte, much more so than these new challenges.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I think if she was going to lose on that issue, that would have happened last time around.
I think she's pretty strong, but I think it's partly because she's put in a lot of work to be here.
So Patrick Register says she's too old, but Gabriel Ortiz points out that the average age of citizens in the district is 35 with kids. And he said, quote, we don't have anyone in D.C. representing their interests. Has Alma Adams responded to that charge?
She's pretty much dismissed the charge.
And do you have to be? Can you not be 71 and represent a 35-year-old?
Well, I guess you can.
You know what it's like to be 35.
But going back to the generational thing, you're absolutely right in terms of the voting age population. But if you look at who actually voted, unfortunately, millennials are underrepresented. They're not going to the polls as strongly as their numbers suggest they could.
You think that's going to change, given the political climate in which we live now?
I do. as a resident millennial on this panel, I think
pontificate.
You know,
go ahead.
Notwithstanding nerds like me who've always been involved in politics, I think that, you know, I'm 28, so I think, you know, most of my peers in my age group are starting to, you know, buy houses, have jobs, have children, and it starts to focus you in on, you know, oh boy, these issues going on really impact me. And I think you're starting to see that. I mean, look at the number of millennials elected to the Charlotte City Council last year.
I was going to bring that up. Is that just serendipity, or is that indicative of something that's about to happen nationally in the midterms?
Well, I think it is something that just – and also just naturally is going to happen, because as people in my generation start to get older, they're in places in life and business and what have you where they can start to run and get involved in that kind of stuff. And – people, millennials, you can knock us all you want, but, you know, we all have jobs.
We do.
Work hard. Yes, I will speak up on our behalf for a moment. And we're interested in getting involved in things that we are passionate about. And yeah. I think you're starting to see more people passionate about where they live.
The other
As we
thing
discussed
that I would...
at the election time, though, too, it's not enough to just be a millennial. People are not voting for the demographic, because we had some candidates for school board where you would think it would be really important to have young people, and they didn't run as strong a campaign as these city council members did, and they did not get elected.
That was exactly the point I was going to make. It's not just that the city council millennials were millennials. They were very charismatic. Mm-hmm. They were people who felt passionately about issues. They were people who had taken stands on some controversial things. So they didn't just step up and say, vote for me because I'm young.
Okay. And very smart, by the way.
No, but I'd say a lot of their positions that they took were informed by their age and perspective in life.
Absolutely.
So Alma Adams just recently, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, in the last election became the representative from the 12th District because they had redrawn the district.
She'd already always been the representative from the 12th District. She just became the representative from the 12th District that only encompassed and was in Mecklenburg County.
Okay. And so she spent four terms in Washington, and she points out rightly, I think, that every new person who comes to Congress goes to the back of the line. Seniority matters in Washington, meaning that if you're new to Washington, you can come in with all these great ideas and be as idealistic as you possibly can be, but you don't know the players, you don't know the process, you don't know where the bodies are buried, and therefore you don't have any power and no clout to get things done. Is that a reason to return incumbents, however?
I would say generally she's right, but you look at people like Mark Walker, who is the congressman from Guilford County now, who's the chairman of the Republican Study Committee. You look at a guy like Mark Meadows, who's only been in Congress two or three terms, who's chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, hugely influential. So generally speaking, yeah, she's mostly correct. You're not going to get a chairmanship or no one's going to know who you are, but I wouldn't just outright say that that's a reason.
And in all fairness, that's an argument you would expect an incumbent to make.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Of course, of course. Meanwhile, yesterday, The Observer, and probably us, reported that several candidates running congressional races, including Gabriel Ortiz and Keith Young, both Democrats, and Carl, is it Person, P-E-R-S-S-O-N, a Republican, all three are running in the 12th District, as well as Scott Huffman, a Democrat running in the 8th. All of them have a couple of problems in their background, running from IRS liens to bankruptcies to unpaid debts. Have they explained these things to the voters?
Well, they've explained them to The Observer. This is something we always traditionally do. You know, everybody who runs for office, we run a criminal and civil check to see if there are things that potentially voters might want to know about. And it's always interesting to see what they do say about it. A lot of these are financial. We did have one who actually was charged with, and that was Paul Bonham, I think, a Republican running in the 12th, assault with a deadly weapon, and he said it was a fist fight and that he pleaded guilty to an assault he did, or to a crime he didn't actually commit. So again, do voters know or care about that? I guess we'll find out. He's also a Republican in a heavily Democratic district, so maybe won't matter all that much.
Does any of the the current environment, does any of this matter? I mean, does any of it matter? Can you go out there and do anything in the world and still run for office unashamedly?
I think it matters. I think it matters more locally than it does nationally, because locally, these races and government is inherently less political. When you start to talk about national races, I'm beginning to wonder.
Okay. Over in the 9th Congressional District, Republican Robert Pittenger is facing Mark Harris, a challenge from Mark Harris, who is urging voters to drain the swamp. This is Mark Harris urging voters to drain the swamp and accusing Pittenger of being allergic to the truth. I don't know, but I think some might find irony in the use of a phrase from the Trump campaign to support their cause, talking about being allergic to the truth. But the other irony is that Pittenger accused Harris in 2016 of trying to stop Trump. Any truth to these statements at all? Is this just politics?
I think it's posturing on both sides, and it's fascinating. You know, there was talk of Mark Harris being supported by Steve Bannon and you know, folks more closely tied to the Trump administration. And then you have Robert Pittenger, who, if you have done an interview with him any time in the last year, is clearly posturing to be more closely aligned with President Trump. Mm-hmm. So it's really going to be a contest of who is more like Donald Trump in the ninth district Republican primary.
And that will play in that district?
I believe both men have clearly decided and made a decision, their campaigns have made a decision, that that is what the Republican voters in the primary are going
to
vote.
And probably if you're not crazy about Trump, you're planning to vote for the Democrat in that rather than the Republican primary.
And the other thing that's really worth mentioning, and this is just came out in the last couple of days as first quarter finance reports have been filed, but Robert Pittenger did not raise a ton of money last year, has some senior congressional leadership coming down to raise money for him now because he's kind of short on cash. He's facing a fairly strong challenge from Harris. And then whoever wins the primary is going to have to contend with a serious Democrat challenger as well. So,
but he's been spending money, Pittenger, because he had campaign commercials running at Christmas time.
He has been spending money, but so he just – he has not raised as much money as you might expect a incumbent.
Deliberately or because he can't? Or do we know?
It's an interesting question, isn't it?
I don't know that anybody ever chooses not to raise money.
Yeah, I don't think he's clearly running, and any incumbent who wants to keep their seat would want to raise as much as you can, but there are all sorts of different factors for that. But bottom line, I think, is, you know, Pittenger barely survived. I mean, what was it, like 30 votes? Barely survived the Republican primary 2 years ago. He has another, you know, challenge from one of the guys who almost beat him 2 years ago, and then if he wins, he's going to have a serious challenge in the general election, too.
And in one race,
and that general election is where things might get tricky. It's an old truism in politics that conservatives run to the right during the primary and then try to move back toward the center during the general. So the trick will be, after aligning himself, whoever the winner is, after aligning himself so closely with Trump in an off-year election, how successful will he be in being able to move back to the center to capture the general?
And we only have 30 seconds here, but in one race in Mecklenburg County for the North Carolina House, the County Board of Elections voted along party lines on a complaint challenging the voter registration of Brandon Lofton, who is running to unseat Andy Doolin, the incumbent in House District 104. What did the board decide, and why was this in question?
Quickly. It was in question because he changed his voter registration to an address where he had put a contract on a house but didn't live yet. They decided that there wasn't enough evidence to prove he'd committed a crime.
Brouhaha over the word taxes and the word Panthers in the same sentence. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFA. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on Fridays at 9, Saturdays at 7. Be there if you can. I'll tell you who is here. Glenn Berkins is here from the QCityMetro.com. He's publisher and editor there. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Nick Oxner from WBTV News. The for sale sign obviously is up at the Panthers. And in recent weeks, potential buyers have been coming to town to check us out. Who is here this week?
Ben Navarro from Charleston. And you've just exhausted the knowledge about it.
I think David Tepper.
Tepper was also here. And then the third guy from Canada was also
here last week.
Yeah, was here last week. And these are the three that we know have seriously been kicking the tires on this deal. And we also know have the $2.5 billion that it would cost to buy the team.
Okay, so the Ben Navarro's from Charleston. He's a rich guy. They're all rich guys. David Tepper is a hedge fund billionaire, minority owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he was supposed to be here yesterday, I think, or the day before yesterday.
The day before.
Must have been the day before.
Yeah,
I can always tell by whether the Jumbotron's playing.
Are any of these people, any of them, making themselves available to the media, or is this all on the QT because it's
hard to say it's on the QT because, you know, every news outlet in the state is camped outside of the stadium watching these people come and go at this point. But no one has talked, and it's all hush-hush at this point.
Right. Well, there's some concern, and there has been for some time, about what an owner change for the Panthers might mean, not the least of which surrounds the future of the stadium and what a new owner might demand of the city in that area. And there was a story going around this week that the Charlotte Chamber had suggested a tax to keep the team in the city. Chamber President Bob Morgan said that was not true, but he took to YouTube to set the record straight.
We have very publicly acknowledged and will continue to acknowledge that public-private partnerships are a reality in professional sports. We ask and encourage all elected officials to join in the effort to retain the Carolina Panthers in Charlotte and to be open-minded to all potential solutions to meet this opportunity.
So would not a special tax be something an open-minded person might consider in order to meet this potential opportunity?
Sorry, it probably would be. Certainly some use of tax money, whether it's an additional new tax, which I think was the biggest point of dispute, whether he actually suggested adding a tax. And he might be saying, I'm open to anything if that were to come about, but that's different from saying, you know, the chamber went in and called for it.
I'm sure that's how the spirit in which he made his comments. Well, everything should be on the table.
The chamber is clearly working behind the scenes because I'm not going to make light of this. This is very important to the future of Charlotte to keep this team here. There's no question about it. I mean, you can hate football, don't care about football, think it's all a boondoggle for the. It's not. There are intangible benefits to having the Panthers here, and losing them would be a major blow, it seems to me. But Bob Morgan has said that any claims of the chamber proposing a tax to keep the team in the city are false. That's a quote. But the chamber has said that his statement at a meeting in Ballantyne was purely hypothetical. So he did say it. Mecklenburg County Commissioner Pat Cotham told WBTV that Morgan had talked about city, county, and state collaborating to help the Panthers. So at that meeting, she stood up to point out that the county did not have a revenue stream for sports, at which time Bob Morgan said, well, we could add a tax. And Channel 9 spoke to Cotham about this, and she left little doubt about how she feels about a tax for the Panthers.
No, 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 no.
So
that's not on her table, apparently.
Apparently not.
I think she's unclear on the issue.
So was this this tax comment simply off the cuff, a riff on because of a question from the audience?
This sure seems that way, and I think that's what Bob Morgan would argue if he were sitting in this chair. Yes, and
And in fairness, that's probably the truth. I think the word proposal is where people probably get hung up. When you think of a proposal or that someone proposed something, that it's more official than just kind of saying, you know, hey, what do you think of this idea?
Yeah. So how do other commissioners feel about the possibility of some sort of tax to generate revenue for a new stadium or whatever the new owner might request?
I don't think anyone's jumping up and down for it at this point. I think it would probably take a threat of losing the team before anyone would actually come out and
But even then, I'm not sure that you're going to get the county commissioners to say, yeah, let's levy a new tax. I mean, when you have a conservative Democrat, Pat Cotham, you have the three Republicans on the council pretty unanimously. I'm not sure we've heard explicitly from Jim Puckett, but I can't imagine he would stray too far from the other Republicans, all saying, much like Pat Cotham, no, no, no. I don't think it would ever happen.
Well, Channel 9, if you'll pardon the expression, Channel 9
I read their article about
reached
it.
Out to all nine. Four said unequivocally no. DeMont Clark said he would not be inclined. Ella Scarborough, Trevor Fuller, Vil Malik, George Dunlap did not respond. And County Manager Dina DiOrio said it is too premature to comment at this time.
And with all due respect to all the people who said no, I've seen this before. As I said, let the new owners, whoever they are, visit San Diego or wherever and start shopping the team around, and we may see people saying something different.
And, of course, the county's only one part of the equation. There's the city to consider, too. What has the city had to say about this, if anything?
Well, I think the city clearly telegraphed that they were preparing to meet the realities of a new stadium talk in last year's debate over the soccer stadium. I mean, when they pretty clearly said, we don't want to pump a bunch of money into the soccer stadium because we know we're going to have to pump a bunch of money into a Panthers stadium in the not too distant future. So I think they've pretty clearly recognized that this expense is coming and they're trying to save their hotel revenue dollars to support that.
Well, it is now time to move on to another topic.
No.
Thank you.
No. No, no.
Well, I'm sorry, Pat. We must move on. CMPD Chief Kurt Putney, who has said that arming teachers is not the way to make children in school safe, said this week that all CMS schools should restrict entry to one point and wand everyone who comes in. He called it essential to keeping guns out of school.
It's a sad statement. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to have to screen students and staff who come into class. It's not what I want to do. But I think it's the best way to make sure nobody gets a gun inside of it.
That's CMPD Chief Putney talking to folks at a community meeting in Steel Creek this week. Is wanding practical? Could it be done, really?
Boy, it's a stretch. I mean, you start with the campuses, and that was why in my story I included the example of West Charlotte High School, which is the kind of campus that is horrible for security. It's a big, sprawled place with multiple traffic entrances and multiple buildings and large numbers of students coming and going, not only at the beginning and the end of the day, but during class changes. And they actually have, the voters have approved, part of the bond plan was turning that into the kind of single building that is much easier to secure. The cost for that is $110 million, and it is scheduled for completion in 2022.
Now that's consider just one school.
Right, and consider that Dr. Wilcox, the superintendent, has said, I'm going to ask for somewhere between $9 and $10 million. That is not going to, we're talking dozens of schools that have that kind of layout that are very hard to secure. And you talk about the high schools already start at 7:15 in the morning, which many, many families and teens do not love. Mm-hmm. How much earlier do you have to report to get 1,500 to 3,000 students through an airport-style screening point? And when you start telling families, okay, you need to be here at 6:45 a.m.
And wanding is not walking through those detectors. It's actually having a person
stand
there and wand.
And that's actually what I wondered, did he mean literally wanding or just walking through metal detectors?
I think he meant literally wanding because people were asking him, the families who came to that event, I was there, were very concerned about school safety and wanted to know what he was saying. And they kind of kept pressing him on it. And he was saying, yes, I mean a metal detector wand. He used that phrase several times.
I guess this will be an ongoing discussion because he's very much opposed to having teachers armed in schools, as is Clayton Wilcox. And this is something, clearly people want something done to protect their kids, and that you can't argue with that. So I guess we'll have a discussion on this going forward. You reported this week that none of the 37,000 CMS volunteers who do everything from reading to students to acting as chaperones on school trips, none of them are protected from being sued, and CMS has no policy to provide a legal defense when they are sued. How big a problem is this? Do bunches of people get sued?
No, and apparently this is why there's no policy, which actually kind of surprised me. I sort of assumed in the same way that CMS gets sued periodically and most of it's dealt with behind closed doors. Legal advice is one of the things that the board can legitimately go into closed session for. I guess I just thought there were probably volunteers in there. But when a parent at Eastover Elementary School sued two volunteer parents, along with various faculty and administrators and the school board, and this was over a child's food allergies, apparently everyone went sort of said, oh, we've never had to deal with this. And I called the North Carolina School Boards Association to sort of see, is this for real? And their lawyer, their chief counsel, who's been there like 20 years, said the same thing. She said, I've never heard of this happening. So there's kind of people are now kind of going, oh, well, what do we do about this?
You know, schools around the country have dealt with truancy for years, truancy with students, and they don't like it, and there are laws about it and things like that. But evidently, you're reporting this morning in the paper, and that their teachers are truant. Substitute teachers are used in classrooms all over the country as well to help sub for teachers who take a day off here or there. But you're saying that around this state last year, 22.6% of all teachers were chronically absent from work. That's about 22,000 teachers because we have about 97,000 teachers in the state.
And over the past 3 years, 42% had hit that mark at least one of those past 3 years.
Thanks. Why?
Well, that's a great subject of debate. And the teachers are a little bit sensitive even about the way that the State Department of Public Instruction is defining this. By using the term chronic absence, it does sound like truancy. It does sound like they're slacking on the job. And in fact, the HR director talked about, well, they're seeing this as a short-term career, essentially saying that if you're taking those days, you're perhaps not taking your job very seriously.
Yeah.
And if you are looking at it from the point of view of the students, you do want the regular teacher in front of that classroom every single day if possible.
It costs money. You can't have an empty classroom. You have to bring somebody in.
And that's part of the dynamic that the teachers have cited. Teachers accumulate 10, over the course of a 10-month school year, 10 sick days. And many of them would say that's a benefit that we need to use, not only if we get sick, but if our kids get sick, if we need to take them to a doctor's appointment. They also get 2 days of personal leave, which they can take during a classroom day. But then, according to one of the teachers who I believe is correct on this, they have to pay $50 toward a substitute, whereas they don't have to pay $50 if they take a sick day. So I think one of the questions becomes, how are these benefits defined? If you want to achieve the goals of, A, doing everything you can to get teachers to be there with their kids as much as possible, but B, treating them like professionals. I mean, I get sick days that I can't cash out at the end of the year, but it's really easy for me to have a little flexibility and go, you know, when I took my mom to a doctor's appointment this week and it was no big deal, I didn't have a classroom of kids sitting there without me.
Right. State education officials say that this stems in part from teachers who no longer view the profession as something they'll stay in for the rest of their lives. They also caution not reading so much into this data. So which is which? Is it because they're disillusioned with their profession, or is it and it sounds serious. It's 22,000 people.
Yeah.
But they say don't take this too much. Don't give too much thought to that.
Well, again, that becomes the challenge of saying what they are doing when you're talking about 22,000 people. You probably have everything from people who view this as a benefit that they're paid for, and if I get this, I'm going to cash it out. I'm going to take those 10 days. Teaching is very tiring, I think, mentally and physically. I'd probably want to take the 10 days, but that's probably why I'm not a teacher.
I don't want to run out of time, but Project Lift has been in existence for 7 years, and it's it takes place mostly in schools in West Charlotte. It's still struggling academically. It's geared at helping these kids succeed in school. They spent more than $100 million on this effort in 10 schools, but they're performing below expectations. How far below expectations, and does anybody know why?
Yeah, and we probably don't have nearly the time to get into this. We've talked about it multiple times. This popped up, and I have written also, because it is nearing the end of its time, the test scores are nowhere near what you would like to see them. They are still fairly similar to the other high-poverty, low-performing schools.
Here's a question I have, because we don't have a lot of time. They set a target of raising reading and math proficiency to 90%. It was at 50%. It's, I think, now at, 88%?
Reading and math, no.
No?
Only one school.
It's at 50%. They set a goal of 90% also for graduation rate, and it is at 88%. So if graduation rates have risen, but reading and math scores have not, are we just pushing these kids out the door?
That is a huge topic that could be, yes. Consistently, you have seen schools that have seen big increases in graduation rates, but still have very low performance on test scores, including things like the ACT that measure college readiness.
Meanwhile, in Raleigh, the General Assembly has decided to hold off on deciding whether or not you can break up large school districts. Why?
Well, I think they, late last year, said, well, this is something we ought to study to see if it'd be more efficient than the current system we have. Let's have a committee on it.
And this is Bill Brawley's idea for Matthews? Was it his idea?
He's the chair of the committee, right?
Yeah, he is. And I don't know that it was his idea, okay. But he certainly has been the proponent of studying it and looking at it. So the committee has met 4 times now. And this last time, the committee that was supposed to be studying whether or not schools should break up basically had a hearing that didn't really talk about that. And it was Bill Brawley announced we're not going to split school districts up, which is
off the table for now.
Anytime a legislator says there's just this bill sitting over there, nothing to see, keep an eye on it.
Okay. Well, I hate to tell you this, but we are completely out of time.
No. Yes. No. No, no.
Yes, 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 we are. Thank you. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter of the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Thank you all for the hour. And you too, Pat. Thanks.